The New York Times has recently called Steve Reich our greatest living composer, and The Guardian London has stated that there's just a handful of living composers who can legitimately claim to have altered the direction of musical history, and Steve Reich is one of them. In 1990, he received a Grammy Award for Best Contemporary Composition, and in 2009 was awarded the Pulitzer Prize in Music for his composition Double Sextet. Mr. Reich is visiting the Knoxville area as the featured artist of this year's Big Ears Festival, taking place this weekend in downtown Knoxville. The festival is named for someone who is capable of perceptive listening and who has the ability to use the ears as a creative tool, or who hears things many may miss. The goal of the Big Ears Festival is to entertain, excite, provoke, and inspire the creative spirit in all who attend. A few days ago, I spoke with Mr. Reich by phone, and I learned a little more about his works that will be performed at the festival and a little bit about his compositional inspiration and process and some other topics as well. Steve Reich, it is truly such an honor and privilege to talk with you today. Thanks so much for taking time to speak with me.
My pleasure.
Several of your works are being presented at the Big Ears Festival. Which ones are being performed?
Music for 18 musicians is going to be done by Signal, and they're also going to do Radio Rewrite, which refers to Radiohead, actually. And then Johnny Greenwood from Radiohead will be playing Electric Counterpoint. And they're all pieces I'm really very happy with.
How are these works chosen?
I think they wanted to do large pieces. I've left out drumming. Hey, the complete drumming lasts an hour, and it's going to be done by Soap Percussion and Friends. So, what they basically wanted to do, and I was very pleased to see this, they wanted to do, not just a little piece, but some major pieces and more than one and on several nights. So that's very appealing, very ambitious, and that's good.
Well, let's talk a little bit about each one of these pieces. Let's start with the earliest one, drumming. What type of ensemble is this scored for, and what inspired its composition?
I was a drummer when I was 14. I took piano lessons as a child when I was younger. But at the age of 14, I heard for the first time in my life Igor Stravinsky, The Rite of Spring.
Mm-hmm.
A few weeks later, I heard the fifth Brandenburg of Johann Sebastian Bach. I only heard music from Haydn to Wagner, and no Baroque music and no contemporary music. And then I heard bebop, Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, and the drummer Kenny Clarke. I had a friend who was a better pianist than I was and who was getting into jazz, and we said, we got to start a band. I said, I'm going to be the drummer. And I immediately started studying snare drum with Roland Koloff, who later became the timpanist with the New York Philharmonic. So I played my way through high school and college. And when I went to Juilliard, I went back to the keyboard. So drumming comes out of me being a drummer. But how is it scored? It's scored for four pairs of tuned bongo drums, stand mounted and played with sticks. And that takes about 20, 25 minutes. And then it goes into a section for three marimbas and two women's voices. And then that goes into a section all without pause into for three glockenspiels, whistling and piccolo. And at the end, everything all together. So it's a percussion ensemble with wind, piccolo, and voices. And it's a unique kind of scoring. But again, most of my pieces are not scored for conventional ensembles.
Music for 18 musicians comes next chronologically. Was this your first work for a larger ensemble?
Well, when I was a student, I wrote for orchestra, but as a professional out in the world, it was growing. Drumming was 12 musicians and singers, and this was adding six more, but it's a drastically different piece. Drumming basically doesn't change key for an hour. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's one little modulation in the glock section, but basically you stay in six sharps for an hour, and it seems to work. But that's a very particular way of working. Great rhythmic complexity and great contrapuntal melodic interaction, but harmonic, very static. And Music for 18 Musicians is kind of breaking free of all of that. And there's more harmony, I have often said, in the first 5 minutes of Music for 18, and there wasn't all the works that preceded it laid end to end. It was also scored for all the instruments of the orchestral families, except brass, which I've never been particularly drawn to. There's two bass clarinets that have a very, very prominent role. There's the violin and cello. And there are four women's voices, and then there are four pianos, count them. And let's see, three marimbas, two xylophones, and one vibraphone who acts as the conductor, because there's no conductor for Music for 18 Musicians. That was one of the basic ideas, is that the players would take over that function. And this is something that I learned from having studied drumming in Ghana and having studied Balinese gamelan, where an ensemble is kept together by one leader of the ensemble who is one of the players. And, of course, this is an old Western tradition. In Bach's time, the first violinist or the keyboard player would simply just nod to the other players and off they go. So music for 18 lasts about an hour, and it was originally recorded for Deutsche Grammophon, actually, in a pop studio in Paris. It sat in a can for 2 years and was finally released by ECM Records, which was a jazz label, which was starting to branch out into new music, and was released in 1978 and sold over 100,000 copies the first year, which is not what usually happens to classical recording. This is back in the vinyl days. And it really brought me to the attention of people who were classical audiences, who were, quote, progressive rock audiences, the Bowie and Eno type people who were keenly aware of what I was doing, and jazz audiences. And in short, it brought me to an audience that really was mine, and this piece really got to them. So it was a bit of a life changer.
Why do you think it appealed to so many different audiences?
Well, because I'm a person who played jazz, and I'm a person who was a drummer, and I was a person who listened to non-Western music, and all these things were in the air. And I'm not trying to do anything except be myself, but my background was different, and it was coming at a time. When I went to music school, there was one way to write music, and that was the way of Stockhausen, Boulez, Cage. No harmony, no melody of any recognizable sort. And nothing you could tap your foot to. If you did any of those things, you were considered naive and insufferable, and you were laughed at. And if you think I'm exaggerating, the titan of the age, Igor Stravinsky, felt obliged to try his hand at this. Of course, being who he was, he wrote several masterpieces like Gagan and Canticum Sacrum and other pieces using his version of this kind of material. But it was very, very much a political must. And I became a composer because I love Bach, because I love Stravinsky, because I love jazz. And I admired the craftsmanship, the Stockhausen, Boulez, Cage, etc. But it wasn't something that I had any emotional attachment to. And I couldn't envision my life spent doing that. So I just did what I really wanted to do, which I'm talking now in the 1960s. I was regarded as either a simpleton or a maniac or a combination of both. And my audience was really primarily in the visual arts and the dancers and the filmmakers, and very few composers and no academic. My ensemble would give concerts at music schools. You'd get a good audience, but no one from the faculty of the music department would show up. And then gradually, I'd say, maybe 1980s, things began to change, and now I'd say that I'm part of, along with Phil Glass and John Adams and Michael Nyman and Terry Riley and Arvo Pärt, are part of the dominant voice in concert music on the face of the globe.
The guitarist Johnny Greenwood from Radiohead is performing your piece Electric Counterpoint, which was originally recorded in 1987 by guitarist Pat Metheny. I believe it's scored for 12 electric guitars, 2 bass guitars, which are all pre-recorded, and then there's 1 live guitar. How does one, or how will Greenwood perform this in front of a live audience? Is he using pre-recorded tracks, or how does that work?
Absolutely. That's the way everybody, there are performances from time to time, mostly at schools where they have lots of guitarists. But basically, the piece was written for Pat to play, or for any guitarist to play, as a kind of recital piece. Now, Pat Metheny is a jazz guitarist, so after playing it a few times in public, he didn't play it that many times. Mm-hmm. But many other guitarists have. As a matter of fact, it's one of my most performed pieces. And Johnny Green will perform it with his own pre-recordings. In other words, it's easy to rent a tape of Pat Metheny from Boosley & Hawkes, my music publisher, and then, it's no longer a tape, it's computer files, but then it's played back, and you practice at home, and then you play it in public against those tracks, which you can hear in a monitor speaker that's right on stage and everybody else can hear. And whoever you are, you're amplified up enough so everybody knows who you are as opposed to the tape. Johnny Greenwood went to the trouble of creating his own backing tracks, which is a considerable amount of time and effort in the studio, and came up with a version that's uniquely his and sounds like him. And I was very impressed with it. I met him in Krakow, Poland, of all places, in 2009, I think it was. And I knew that he had gone to Oxford as a violist originally. And I also knew that he was himself a composer and had written music for a number of films, one of which, There Will Be Blood, I saw, maybe you've seen it, And if you have, and you listen to the music, you would think this is a guy who listens to Olivier Messiaen, stuff like that. You would never think, hey, this guy's a rocker. So I thought, you know, this is very interesting. Here's a guy who's a rock star, who's a composer, who's a, you know, a violist. And we got to talking, and I mean, I just really liked him. He's just a really good guy, a very, very bright musician, and he did a great job with the piece, and I'm delighted that he's made it part of his repertoire that he performs. So that's how that came to be.
The newest of your pieces to be performed at the festival is Radio Rewrite, which was actually inspired by two songs from Radiohead. Of their songs were you inspired by?
Well, what happened was after meeting Johnny Greenwood, as I just told you, I came back and I thought to myself, you know, I've heard of Radiohead for sure, but I've never heard any of their music, and this is ridiculous. So I've got to hear some of their music. So I went online, and I went to their site, and I listened to a lot of stuff, and I looked at some videos, and I was particularly knocked out by Everything in Its Right Place, which became very popular. I think it's from their album Kid A. Mm-hmm. And the other tune was from the Rainbows album, more recent, called Jigsaw Falling Into Place. And I thought to myself, well, you know, I would just like to take some of the harmonies, particularly from Jigsaw Falling Into Place, and a little bit of the Everything 151 from Everything in Its Right Place, and use them, you know, I don't know exactly how, but it got my energy going. And really the most important thing when you're starting a piece is to get your energy going and to have something that you want to do and you get an idea how to do it. And it was scored, the commissioning body was the London Sinfonietta, amongst other groups. So it was written for non-rock instruments. There's one electric bass, which I love, probably my favorite rock instrument. And everything else is one flute, one clarinet, string quartet, two pianos, and two vibes. So it's not a, quote, rock piece the way I've written a piece called 2x5, which is scored for a rock group. But Radio Rewrite is really just a piece of chamber music. It is rhythmic. On the other hand, it has two very slow movements. Basically, how the tunes work out is this. There are five movements played one after the other without a pause. And the first and third and fifth are fast, and they take from Jigsaw Falling Into Place, and mostly they deal with its harmonies. And the second and fourth movements are slow and slightly mysterious, and they take material from Everything in Its Right Place. And I think it's a very enjoyable piece. When you're listening to it, you may or may not catch traces of Radiohead, but they're there, and then they vanish, and then they come back. But it's really a peace of mind with inspiration from them.
What about their music lends itself to being able to be melded into a piece of classical music?
Well, we have a misconception. I don't know how we can be so misconceived. If you go back to the Renaissance in the West, in Europe, all the way from Dufay, all the way up to Palestrina, every one of those composers, Ockeghem and Josquin, wrote a Misa Lomarmé, a mass on the French popular folk tune Lomarmé. Now, writing a mass was like writing a symphony in those days, and he felt obliged to use this folk song. Okay, now let's jump to Haydn, 104th Symphony, dum-bum-bum, bum-bum-bum. It's an Austrian drinking song. Beethoven's 6th Symphony, first movement, ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum, folk song. It's called Béla Bartók. There's not a piece of Béla Bartók, forget about the folk song singings, every bit of his music is infused with the Serbo-Croatian and Hungarian folk music that he studied. He went out with a Edison recorder strapped to his back. He wrote these things down. Igor Stravinsky, Petrushka and the Rite of Spring, and Firebird, filled with Russian folk songs. He denied it for political reasons, but it's been shown clearly that they're there, much to his credit. Charles Ives, all the hymn tunes that he played as an organist. He was a church organist to make a living for a while, and then he became an insurance salesman. His three places in New England and many other pieces filled with the church tunes that he played himself. Kurt Vile, student of Busoni, he writes an opera. What do you think? He'd get an opera singer and an orchestra. No, I want a saxophone. I want trap drums. I want this woman who can't really sing. Result, masterpiece, the three-penny opera. Mm-hmm. George Gershwin, is he our greatest composer or is he our greatest songwriter? Well, he's a bit of both. Mm-hmm. So this is not something new. This is a restoration of normalcy. It would be strange, it would be totally wacky not to be borrowing back and forth. That's the history of Western music. It's only in this little pocket of time, as I told you, when I went to music school, where there was a large wall or the window was shut between the street and the concert hall. Normally that window was open, and what my generation did, in a sense, was just open the window.
I've had people ask me, people who are genuinely curious, why is classical music relevant today? It seems like people don't really listen to it. It's quote-unquote old music. Is it old music, and what keeps it relevant, in your opinion?
I want to talk about notated and non-notated music.
Okay.
And the classical music, strictly speaking, refers to Haydn, Mozart, and let's throw Beethoven in. And, of course, you know, there are a lot of people that like some of that, a lot of people that don't care about it. But I'm much more interested in the Baroque period that preceded that. I'm interested in the music from Johann Sebastian Bach, and then earlier, going all the way back to the 12th century, Perrotin. And I know a lot of kids got into Gregorian chant a few years ago. They were selling it at the checkout counter in record stores, when there were still record stores, and they were selling it probably at Starbucks, too. So here's a generation of kids listening to rock and roll, and why do they listen to Gregorian chant? I don't know. Maybe because they really think it's beautiful, and they have a gut-level reaction to it. I think the term classical music just conjures up images of little old ladies sitting in boxes, you know, I don't know. Be specific, and suddenly the problem vaporizes. I would say that right now, the music between the classical and romantic period isn't as interesting to as wide a body of people as is, let's say, more recent contemporary classical music, starting with Stravinsky and Bartok and Ravel and Britten. And I would say that, fortunately, in my generation, I mean, here I am at a rock festival, and I'm a classical composer, so I mean, or I'm a person who writes notated music. When Radiohead puts together their tunes, which are very well put together, they do them by playing things for each other. Say, hey, here's the bass, I want you to try this. And they trade ideas back and forth by playing them, with not the need of notation. I discussed this with Johnny Greenwood because there was some question of Radiohead playing in an earlier piece of mine. He was the only person in the group that really read music. But, of course, music began without notation. Mm-hmm. Notation really only came in about a little over 1,000 years ago. So before that, people had plenty of music. So I think that the good news is that the composers living today, who I mentioned earlier, have a wide audience. They are listened to frequently. They have the kind of listenerships that you would expect from people who were in the pop field, or maybe not that scale, but they're known, they're listened to, they're enjoyed. People go they don't go there to do a dutiful act. They go there because they enjoy the music, and the music is not always played. John Adams is the only one I mentioned who really is an orchestral writer. John really writes for the orchestra and has created a great deal of orchestral works, which I think are going to survive, no question about it. And he's listened to by that audience. Pierre, he writes primarily religious music for chorus. He has written some orchestral works, but he's writing for the church. Imagine that. And he has a tremendously wide audience on record, so obviously he's doing very well. Myself, Lass Riley, and other Americans who are younger, Nyman, David Lang, and Michael Gordon, Julie Wolf, these are people who all have ties in one way or another to what's going on in non-notated music, in what you would call pop music. And as I say, all of this has produced a very healthy situation where listeners really enjoy what we're doing, and that is extremely gratifying.
It seems that you are continually evolving as a composer while still maintaining your own style and unique traits. But how do you keep being inspired, and where do you find your inspiration?
Well, it keeps varying. I mean, we didn't talk about a whole bunch of pieces that are very different than this. I mean, I want to grab you for a piece called Different Trains. And a piece like Different Trains, it harkens back to the very first works of mine that ever came to public attention. They're recorded on Columbia Records, way back when Columbia Records existed. In the 60s, It's Gonna Rain, which was composed in 65 and I think recorded in 69, and Come Out, which is 66 and recorded in 67. And they were just recordings of repetitions of actually a black Pentecostal preacher and a black kid arrested for murder saying Come Out to show them. But the speech melody was repeated and then played against itself and built up in layers. Mm-hmm. And created a music that people had not really been familiar with. Mm-hmm. And there were no musical instruments. It was just done through tape manipulation of speech. After those two pieces, I kind of left that whole neck of the woods and wrote instrumental music, piano phase, violin phase, drumming, and music for 18 musicians, and launch ensemble. And it wasn't until 1988, 20 years after the tape pieces, that I noticed that a lot of people were using my ideas from Come Out and It's Gonna Rain. And I thought, gee, you know, they learned a lot. What can I learn? And at that time, the phone rang, and it was David Harrington from the Kronos String Quartet. And he said, we'd like you to write a piece for us. I said, I'd be delighted. And At that time, I became aware of the sampling keyboard. Sampling keyboard is basically you buy it in a music store, you plug it into the wall, you play a middle C, nothing happens, because it's basically a digital recorder, and you have to record something into it. Then it will play that back. It won't be a synthesizer imitating a musical instrument. It's a recording device which will play back recordings. This really sounded like exactly what I was looking for, and I thought, wouldn't it be great to use that in the piece with Kronos? The question is, what's in the sampler? Mm-hmm. I knew it had to be speech, so the question was, who's speaking? First, I thought, oh, it'll be Béla Bartók. Béla Bartók actually recorded on the radio, speaking in English shortly before he died in New York City. After a while, I began to say, wait a minute, I'm writing for string quartet. Do I want Béla Bartók sitting on my shoulder? I don't think so. That's a little too much to bear. And then I had an idea with the voice of Ludwig Wittgenstein. Of course, he never even recorded anything. And then I don't know how these train trips I took as a kid between my divorced parents, my father, the lawyer who lived in New York, and my mother, the lyricist and singer living in California, when they were divorced, when I was 1 year old, the court said you have divided custody. So I had spent 6 months with my mother in California and 6 months with my father in New York. And I got back and forth by riding with my nanny, my governess to Virginia, on a train. Because in those days, airplanes were very expensive and not too frequent. Anyway, this idea popped in my head, and I started making recordings of Virginia, the woman who was with me, of Mr. Lawrence Davis, who was a black Pullman porter back in the 40s. He was in his 80s now, and he loved to talk about these trips because that was really his life. That was his heyday. Then I began to ask myself, well, what years did I do this? I did it in 1937, 38, 39. What was going on in the world? Well, we know what was going on in the world. Mr. Hitler was trying to take over the world and taking any Jewish kid or adult and carting them off to far away in Poland, and up the chimney they went. And if I had been born in Stuttgart or Brussels, we wouldn't be having this conversation. So the light went on, and I went up to Yale University. They have an archive of Holocaust survivors, and I listened to them recounting their lives. If somebody said to me, Steve, would you write a piece about the Holocaust? I'd say, are you crazy? Mm-hmm. Do you want me to drink the Atlantic Ocean to get started? Mm-hmm. But I thought to myself, what is Virginia doing in this? And what is Mr. Davis doing? They're talking about their lives. And as they speak, dum, 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 from Chicago, says Virginia, dum, ba, da, da, goes the viola. As they speak, so I write. I literally took dictation the way we do in music school. People play a melody and you write it down. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, if I deal with these Holocaust survivors the same way, then it's their voices, it's their melody, and all the emotions and the innuendos and the meanings are coming from the people who were there and went through it. There's no beating my imaginary chest at something I wasn't a part of. And I thought, this is the key to doing this piece. And it will not be done out in this particular festival in Knoxville, but Griffin Trains is done quite frequently. It's been recorded a number of times. Of course, the first recording was by Kronos, which won a Grammy. And it's a very different way of working. Your question was, how did you get started? This is how I got started for this piece. How did you get started for Music for 18 Musicians? I sat down at the piano and tried to work out a series of harmonies, mm-hmm. which is basically the way composers have done for thousands of years. And so if it's an instrumental piece, I will try to work out the harmonic structure of it first. If it's a piece that uses pre-recorded material, I have to discover what that pre-recorded material is. If it's a vocal piece for singers to sing, like Tehillim or Daniel Variations or UR Variations or Proverb or The Cave or Three Tales, then the words, the text, mm-hmm. has to come first for me. So it depends on the piece. For instrumental music, beside the harmonies, the other crucial question is, what are the instruments?
Mm-hmm. One final question. Will you be in attendance at the Big Ears Festival? And if so, what will you be doing there?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, I'll be there. I'll be playing clapping music on the main concert, Music for 18 concert. We'll start the concert off with a performance of clapping music. See, I traveled with my ensemble for 40 years, and every piece, I could play any piece in drumming, and I played it for 40 years. But I'm not going to play with soul percussion because, you know, I'm not going to be there, and there's no time to rehearse. So I will also be speaking to students at the university in town, and I'll be answering questions. There's going to be a Q&A session that they've set up, I think, between the general public and myself. So I'll be playing and talking and coaching the rehearsals. I'll be there in time for the rehearsals to add whatever I can. Signal hasn't done Music for 18 Musicians before. I know that they're a great group. They really know what I'm doing. I know it's going to be great, but I'm sure I've got a few things I can add to it because I've played that piece maybe 100 times. So that's what I'll be doing in Knoxville.
That was composer Steve Reich, who spoke with me by phone a few days ago. Mr. Reich is the featured artist of the Big Ears Festival, taking place this weekend, Friday through Sunday, in downtown Knoxville. More information is available online at BigEarsFestival.com.